You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. It's 3/2/22, and the war rages on. Precious metals prices right now getting smacked down a bit. We figured we go to somebody who has a pretty uncanny record for calling these markets, or one of the foremost experts. I'm talking about Jeffrey M. Christian. You know him well. Runs the CPM Group. Jeff, great to have you back on. So, crazy world. Wars just happened. Maybe we're in the midst of a war cycle. We could talk about that later. But as far as your projection last year for what precious metals were going to do for the coming year, I mean, we're still emerging from the pandemic. All sorts of insane things. Interest rate hikes, turmoil across the world. Wanted to get your picture of it, your vision of what's transpiring now and how this war could potentially affect precious metals prices.
It's a lot to unpack and cover. Yeah. Obviously the start of active aggression by Russia invading Ukraine changes a lot of dynamics. And, if you go back to a month ago or even, probably 2 weeks ago, we had sort of four areas that we would focus on in talking about what's going on in terms of shorter term influences on the market. One was inflation. One was interest rates. The third one was the Russian saber rattling and mounting on the border of the Ukraine. And the fourth one was investor attitudes toward all of that. Three of those things have sort of taken backstage to the Russian invasion. And the Russian invasion is there. And it's interesting how it's going to shake out. We have different scenarios that we're working on in terms of the military and political outcomes. One is Russia occupies the Ukraine. It will face massive, they'll call it terrorism. It'll face massive opposition as long as it's there. Now, the scary thing is, you look at what Russia did in Chechnya, which was a scorched earth policy. But, Chechnya was full of Caucasian Islamic people. And Putin, who actually executed that devastating bombing of Chechnya, didn't necessarily see them as Russians or Slavs. They were Caucasians, not Slavs. And Ukraine's he sees or claims that he sees as Slavs. So he may take a different approach. But right now, it looks like they're preparing for scorched earth anti-civilian policy. But, if they take control, they will face this insurrection for as long as they're there. And the longer term implications for the world are amazing. And for one thing, Putin's going to lose. Russia's going to lose. Russia already has lost enormous status, an enormous amount of money. It has pivoted Europe and a number of other places away from it in a long-term basis. This is going to be going on for decades, if not centuries, that they will suffer the consequences of this. The biggest winners are the U.S. government and NATO.
What about China?
China is a winner in a way. And it's very funny because, a lot of people think that Russia and China are buddies and stuff, but they're not. They're adversaries. And they fought a war in the late 60s along the Amur River. The poster behind me is a Soviet poster about the Amur River development, Baikal-Amur Railroad industrial complex development in the 70s. But they fought in wars and stuff. And, China has encouraged Russia to be belligerent because, A, it destroys Russia. China no longer has to worry about the Russian giant on its northern border.
And they want They want Siberia. They've been colonizing so many of you out there. Siberia. The Chinese.
I've heard this. I don't know any Chinese person who has designs on Siberia. And I do a lot of work there, you know, and I work with the government. It's not there. I, you know, that's one of those memes that conflict entrepreneurs have been passing around the market. It's nonsense. You can easily avoid that. But what they have done is they've used Russia to sort of sound out how the world would react to military aggression on territories that one country might claim from another. And they've seen something pretty bad. And, you know, the reality is that what the Chinese are facing with Taiwan is actually much worse in terms of what the military reaction would be of any military aggression than what Russia has faced. And, you know, I happen to have a lot of criticisms about how NATO and the U.S. government has behaved in the approach to this. I think they should have been much more aggressive before the invasion. But as I said, they clearly understood the benefits that would accrue to NATO, to the U.S. government, to the U.S. dollar, to the U.S. and European armaments industries, the military industrial complex. They clearly understood the benefits here of letting Putin destroy Russia's military and political and economic base, which is what he's done. Yeah. So if they take over, they have an insurrection. The price of gold stays somewhat high, but it doesn't necessarily rise further. If the Ukrainians win, the price comes back down to where it was, you know, in December or most of last year. And as you said, yeah, you know, we were pretty good at calling the gold price and the silver price last year in that we were saying, you know, this was going 2021, 2022, were going to be consolidation years. And I think we go back into that consolidation at a lower level. You know, the third one is that this war takes longer to prosecute, and that keeps the gold price high about where it is now. You know, I think we have a range of 1890 to 1980 as our range for gold prices over the next few weeks or a couple months, you know. And the fourth one is that NATO gets sucked into this. Either it gets sucked into it by Russia or it chooses to go in. You know, and that one obviously would make the gold price spike higher and then it would come down.
That would be a disaster. NATO getting in there. The Russians are defeating themselves. What did James Carville say when your opponent is sinking, throw him an anchor, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
They've taken too long. The Russians, they thought they were going to just march in and be welcomed. And now they're facing resupply of all the missiles to the Ukrainians. So this thing's going to drag on. I don't think there's any question about that. Unless they march in today, you know, before they get resupplied, this thing's going on for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Russian army has had some problems. And, you know, there's clearly divisions now that were growing before the invasion that have gotten worse between Putin and his military leadership. And, you know, but the military has proven disastrous here on the ground with conventional forces. You know, they run out of fuel. They're running out of food. They are finding a very demoralized troops, you know, and then Putin heightened it all with his nuclear threats on the weekend. And you could see from intelligence that the military really did not want that. And Putin demanded it. And that has now changed the pivot of NATO. So the NATO military leadership had a large, long video meeting yesterday morning talking about what they can do to encourage that division and that schism between Putin on the one hand and his military and political leadership on the other hand. You know? And one of the things that Putin has done, like Xi Jinping in China, is he has precluded a leadership process. So he's basically neutralized all of his potential successors. Been in power 22 years old. He's going to turn 70 this year. He's clearly got a number of problems. And he has neutralized anybody who could have been a political replacement for him. So Russia really has economic, political, military issues that, which however this thing prosecute, however the war prosecutes, they're in trouble.
All right. So what about the sanctions, and especially with SWIFT? You know, the Chinese look at it, say that could be us one day. And does that undercut the dollar's dominance in the long run, Jeff?
I don't think it undercuts the dollar's dominance, but it does put SWIFT at risk. And, you know, we have been saying, first off, I think overall the sanctions have been lukewarm. You know, if you really wanted to stop this thing, you had a chance to stop it before the invasion. After the invasion, you simply turn off the oil and gas. You know, Europe will survive somehow or other. They've survived much worse. You turn off the oil and gas, and you turn off those spigots, and you turn off that banking system. And even with the SWIFT announcements that we've made over the weekend and on Monday, we're still allowing them to sell oil and gas to Europe and to the rest of the world.
In the U.S.
Yeah. So it doesn't, you know, it's been very ineffective. But, you know, we have also said that we didn't think they should do this with SWIFT. SWIFT is very good. I mean, you know, if you look at the security of transactions on SWIFT compared to, say, the securities of transactions using distributed ledger protocol, it's a multiple of more secure. You know,
it's a closed system.
Distributed ledger protocols are so, they're like Swiss cheese. Yeah, they are so vulnerable. SWIFT is not, and what you have now done. But you know, that said, SWIFT is what 39 years old. Yeah, 49 years old, 1973 is when it began. You know, it's 49 years old. It's half a century old. It is now politically more vulnerable because, as you said, you know, it's been politicized.
Yeah, interesting situation. Yeah, for sure. It's SWIFT is a closed system, right? For anybody to get into that system to add a new node or anything else, there are very rigid, strict security protocols. And you know, it's sealed off, kind of like the military's own internet that doesn't cross the internet. So everything you're saying about that, absolutely correct. And it's effective, and it moves massive amounts of money around the globe at a moment's notice. So politicization, I can't see why they would mess with that, because then it forces players who might step on the leader's feet to look for alternatives, right?
Yeah. You know, in the run-up to this, people kept saying that they didn't understand, that they thought that perhaps Putin was irrational. And our view was, no, if you see somebody doing something and you don't understand the rationale, you don't understand the rationale. There's a rationale there. You just don't understand it. And the same can be said about why they allowed to do this with SWIFT. Yeah, there's probably a rational reason, and it's probably not a good reason. And it is what it is. But you know, you also talked about the dollar, and this is all probably very good for the dollar. You know, in the long run, it's probably very good for the dollar. It's, you know, you've seen some dollar strength. Now, you have a lot of people who are long term, oh, the dollar is going to collapse. And, oh, the dollar is collapsing. Well, you know, the dollar is 30% higher now than it was at its cyclical peak in July 2011. That was right when the Treasury was being downgraded and the creditworthiness was there. It was in the middle of the international sovereign debt crisis that was going on, which was also, you know, affecting the dollar. The dollar has risen 30% since then. And it's really, you know, it's actually down from where it was in December, but it's still very strong. And all of this probably benefits the dollar. So we don't see the dollar being negatively affected. If anything, we see the dollar being positively affected, because people who are in Europe are going to say, okay, the United States is a better place to have my assets than Europe. And that means buying dollars to move my wealth over to a more secure location.
All right. So crude oil over $100 a barrel. When that happens, we're almost guaranteed a recession, aren't we?
I don't know. I mean, the last time crude oil got over $100, we were already in a recession. I think that it's going to be very problematic. And one of the questions is, how long does it last? Yeah. And we still have not disrupted oil exports from Russia. So regardless of how the war prosecutes itself, oil will probably continue to flow. And it's funny because a lot of people are saying that this reflects the war, and it does. You know, the last $10, $15 reflects the war. But if you look at it, oil had already risen very sharply because of OPEC behavior over the course of 2021 and the economic recovery and other issues that were there. So I think that oil stays high. That will have some inflationary implications, but it'll also have some deflationary implications, and it will reduce, you know, in that it will reduce demand for other goods and services because people will be paying more for their gasoline and their heating oil.
Yeah, it's a tax, basically a tax on everyone. And
so it's a tax that's collected by the oil industry, not by
their personal tax.
I mean, they call it a tax to say that the oil companies run the government.
Well, I wouldn't quite go that far, but there's certainly
call it a tax. but it's not a tax. It's economy. A redistribution of wealth away from consumers to oil companies.
Economists would call it a tax. The industry's tax on the public. But so what about inflation here, Jeff? I mean, it's roaring along. You know, let's just assume that the government's number 7.5% is correct. We all know in many sectors it's higher, but I do hear that the price of fentanyl has gone way down. So at least something's getting cheaper out there, right?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Trilogy Metals is a world-class developer in Alaska's Ambler Mining District. The company already possesses 8 billion pounds of copper, 3 billion pounds of zinc, over 1 million gold equivalent ounces, and now over 77 million pounds of cobalt. Trilogy's Arctic project boasts an after-tax net present value of $1.4 billion with a 33% IRR. Trilogy is led by an experienced management team with proven success in discovering and developing projects in Alaska. The company is well capitalized, has no debt, and possesses strong institutional support. Trilogy trades on the New York and Toronto exchanges under the ticker symbol TMQ. To learn more, go to trilogymetals.com. That's trilogymetals.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
I wouldn't know about fentanyl, I'm sorry to say. Although I think, you know, listening to people talk about inflation and gold and the dollar, I sometimes think I'm the only guy who's not like hooked on cocaine in this industry because the things are so bizarre that they say, you know. But that said, in my sober mood, inflation's a problem. If you study it as an economist, you say probably, and you understood what the government data is, you'd understand that the government data probably measures it pretty well. We have an issue there. I do think that monetary authorities have the capacity to bring it under control. They know much more about inflation and how to control it than they did in the 1970s when we had an extended period of inflation. And you have to remember, I mean, you know, people, they do this all the time. Oh, this is the deepest recession since the Great Depression. Yeah, but it was a 4% recession. And the Great Depression was 12%. Yeah. Oh, this is the highest inflation since 1982. Yeah, it's 7.5% headline, 6% core inflation. And it was 14% back then. And it was above 10% for years. You know, so we've had a spike up to 7.5%. If you go back to January of last year, inflation was 1.2% in the United States. It started to rise in February. So we're 12, 13 months into this recessionary period. There are a lot of factors that are behind the rise in prices. And I think that the monetary authorities have woken up to what's going on. They have more tools and a better understanding of inflation and how they can affect it. But, you know, inflation comes from two places. It comes from monetary largesse and it comes from real economic activity. And the monetary authorities can deal with the monetary largesse and they can suck up excess currencies. They can sell bonds as they did in 1983, 1984, 1988, 1991, 2010. You know, they can deal with the monetary sources of inflation. It's much more difficult with the real economic ones, the supply and the demand for goods and services. And those, there are real pressures coming from that area, which are much harder for monetary authorities to control. It really takes fiscal policy, and the fiscal policy has been absent for decades.
Yeah. It seems like nobody, I haven't heard the deficit mentioned by virtually anyone in Washington, other than a couple of regulars like Rand Paul. Nobody ever talks about the deficit and why it might actually matter.
Talk about the deficit or the Fed. Yeah, twice a year they go up to the Capitol Hill for the Humphrey Hawkins talks, and they say, look, we can only do so much in terms of stanching the bleeding economically. Real reform requires fiscal reform. And we've been telling you this since Greenspan was the Fed chairman, and you've gone the opposite direction. You had a $300 billion deficit back then. Now you have a $1.3 trillion deficit, and you're applauding yourself because it's down from $3.7 trillion. You know, no, you have real problems on the fiscal policy, and that's what you have to get in order to have real economic growth on a sustained basis. And that doesn't depend on Fed policy. That depends entirely on the administration and the Congress, who have been dreadfully negligent. And, you know, as Vice President Cheney said, deficits don't matter anymore.
Yeah, until they do, right? Until they do. And inflation, interesting. I mean, I do remember those inflationary 70s. You know, once the spiral starts, really hard to put the genie back in the bottle, because when people start thinking that your currency is going to be worth less next month, the month after, discourages savings, encourages excess consumption. You get that so-called crack-up boom, where how are we going to bring it under control? Remember, Volcker had 20% interest rates.
Yeah.
Maybe that is too extreme, but they can't even do 10 now. We'd probably have a massive recession, depression, if they were to attempt 10% rates.
Yeah, and you don't need 10% rates. You know, that's a good thing. But yeah, as I said earlier, I mean, we had an extended period of high inflation in the 1970s, and we had monetary authorities who really didn't understand what they needed to do. Volcker was there, and he was saying, this is what we should do. And, you know, for all of the things that you can complain about Jimmy Carter as president, one of the things he did is he said, this is going to cost me the election, but I want you to be the Fed chairman and I want you to kill inflation. And he did. And he threw us into a deep recession. And then when the international debt crisis started to get out of hand in the second quarter of 1982, he opened up the sluices. And it was very funny because he opened up the sluices not only in the United States. He had about 8 central bankers come to Washington and agree to just pour money into the economy. And you know, Jeffrey Moore's leading indicator of inflation index had come out a few years earlier, and it shot way up because it was basically money supply. And gold went from $280 to $500 because everybody was convinced that there was going to be inflation. And within 6 months, we were out of the debt crisis. We had the Brady bonds fixing the Latin debt crisis. We were out of the debt crisis. We were out of the recession. And we had gone from a $60 billion deficit under Carter to $320 billion under Reagan. So the Treasury needed a lot of money. So the bonds started, the Fed started buying bonds and sucking currency out of, selling bonds rather, and sucking currency out of circulation. They sterilized those inflationary implications. Oil went from $40 to $20 within about 2 months. Inflation came down, not to rise until last year. You know, we had 40 years of low inflation. By low, I mean, you know, less than 3% for 40 years. And Volcker sort of showed how it's been done. And we've used that Volcker policy. When you have a problem, you throw money at it. And as soon as you're out of that problem, you sterilize the inflationary implications by selling bonds and sucking up the excess liquidity. And if you look at money supply accurately, a lot of conflict entrepreneurs don't, never took money in banking, I don't think. If you look at money supply versus inflation versus gold prices, you find that 1982, 1983, 1987, 1991, 2001, 2009 to 10, 11, you know, that Volcker policy has worked. Now, we're in a much worse situation now than we were in any of those periods of times. But the view is that's what you do. And so we've thrown enormous amounts of money, fiscal and monetary, at the problems 2020, 2021. And now we've got to work our way out. And it's probably going to take some time to do that, but I think it will happen.
All right. So, you know, a lot of things have exploded in price that aren't reflected in the CPI numbers, like housing, for instance. The only way they reflect housing is the equivalent rent that you could charge for your home. But housing prices are all-time highs, you know, way past anything else. Are we looking at a bubble here? Or rationality, and arguably there's also a shortage of...
Well, you have several things going on with housing. First off, the CPI is a basket that reflects what people buy on a month-to-month basis. And it gets that basket gets adjusted once a year in January. And it reflects what people are buying. Most people don't buy a house every month. So, you know, the purchase price of houses should not be in that. But the cost of ownership of a house or your rent, if you're renting, that goes in there. Now, you look at housing and a third of the people, households rent, a third of the households own but have mortgages, and a third of the households own outright with no mortgage. So the CPI housing index takes into account what the average household is spending month in, month out. Housing prices are capital acquisition, and that doesn't go into the consumer price index per se. Housing prices have skyrocketed for a variety of reasons. There's a shortage. There's a massive differential between what housing exists and what people want and need. There are pressures on the housing industry for a variety of issues. And you have 18% of the houses being bought by, scumbag speculators, but let's call them institutional investors. You know, Mr. Mnuchin made his fortune basically being a slumlord, buying up mortgages and driving people out of their houses. Then he ran to the Treasury for a few years, and now he's back to that. You know, and that 18% of groups of people buying that has actually contributed to it. The other thing, which goes back to the dollar, is you have an enormous number of people from overseas buying U.S. Real estate, housing as well as commercial real estate, as investments, which strengthens the dollar because you need the dollars to buy that, and it pushes the prices of that up.
Yeah. A lot of Chinese investors nearby where I live in Florida, they own tens of thousands of units across the state.
Not just Chinese. I mean, there's Latin Americans, oh, yeah. There's Europeans, there's Russians. I mean, if you could drive, you know, and it's not just the U.S. I mean, you know, the classic place is Belgravia in London. And you drive through Belgravia in London now at night, most of the houses are dark because they're not occupied. They're investments, mostly from Russians and Eastern Europeans. People, you know, so it's a real problem that ought to be addressed, but that's communism, eh?
Yeah, well, these immediate, immediate ICBs, immediate cash buyers that buy the place sight unseen, you know, get mailbox, you know, notes every day from people wanting to buy my house. And it's, I assume, like it's multiplied many fold. So definitely that. Hey, one other thing before I let you go, the Chinese housing bubble. What are your perceptions of that real estate? Chinese real estate, arguably the largest asset class in the world. And what are the repercussions of it?
It's funny because in thinking and preparing myself for this conversation, that was one of the things that came up. Because if you go back 2 months, 6 months, whatever, you know, you find, again, these conflict entrepreneurs, oh, this Chinese housing bubble is going to blow up and the Chinese government can't control it. And it's going to bring down the dollar and it's going to bring down the treasury, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. none of which has happened, partly because that second thing in the analysis was wrong. The Chinese government can control it, and they are controlling it. You know, the glories of having a managed economy run by communists is that you can get things done. You know, in 2008, we said, oh, let's spend $1 trillion to get us out of this recession. And 5 years later, we had allocated $200 billion of it. The Chinese said, let's spend $1 trillion to get us out of this recession. And that afternoon, they were buying rail, you know, steel rails and aluminum for signals. And they were building highways and stuff. That's the glory of a managed economy, if you will. And you've seen this in the housing situation in China. It's not over, but it's clearly manageable. They took a cue from a resolution trust board, which Greenspan put together to get us out of the housing crisis that we had in the late 80s, early 90s. And at the time, if you look at that, what was happening there, at the time, people say this is going to take trillions of dollars and decades to resolve. Greenspan put together the Resolution Trust Corporation, 4 years, $200 billion, and it was fixed. They should have done that in 2008, 2009. Sheila Bair, who was the head of the FDIC, was saying, why aren't you doing this? Greenspan was saying it. Even Paul O'Neill, who was the ex-Treasury Secretary from the early W years, was saying it. And the Chinese watched that. You know, we work with Chinese government entities as clients. And at the time, they were watching what was going on with the dollar, the U.S. economy, U.S. productivity, the Resolution Trust Corp. And they said, this is what we need. But with a managed economy, they're much more effective at managing it and implementing these policies than we are with our dirty democracy.
So they effectively went good bank, bad bank. Right. Just peeled off the bad assets, spun them off into a corporation. I think when the final accounting was done, the government actually turned a profit on the RTC, if I remember correctly, or a very minimal loss, because it was a temporary market disruption. And for a variety of man-made reasons, if I remember correctly, deregulation of banks and such. So, interesting. Well, problems run deep. Solutions are out there. I guess the proof is if people act rationally, you can come up with the rational solutions that work. But we've kind of stopped acting rationally here.
I always say I'm optimistic because I know how these things can be fixed relatively painlessly. But I'm pessimistic because the United States does not have the political will, either on the government leadership level or on the voter level. We simply do the political will that we had. You know, we had 120 some odd percent debt to GDP in 1947. And we drove that down to very low levels by 1981. And we did that because we had the political will to do it. That political will has been destroyed. It's been trampled.
Yeah, so true. So true, Jeff. Well, appreciate your coming on the show, sharing your wisdom and experience with us, and just tell us the site to find your work at.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you having me back on. CPMgroup.com is the website. You can also go to YouTube. We have a channel. We post videos twice a week now, talking about a variety of subjects. We were talking about Ukraine yesterday. We have posted some things on how to invest wisely in gold and silver, how to hedge your investments against downward drafts, like we saw last Thursday. You can read about all that stuff on our website, cpmgroup.com, and what services we have available. And you can go to our YouTube channel and view those things.
All right. Excellent. You got a question for Jeff? You can shoot me an email, kl@carrylutz.com. Don't forget, visit our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Get a free newsletter. Jeff, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for stopping by.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.